The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
We can only accept a certain overvaluation. When the overvaluation goes beyond a certain limit, we cannot live with it. If you have a shock by increasing the value of your currency by 30 or 40% in a short period of time, then you have a serious recession and you could even destroy economic structures. And that's what we cannot tolerate.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney, and we have a guest today, David, that our listeners requested back. After hearing the show a few years ago, we did have listeners who said, when are you going to have Felix Zuloff back?
You know, when I get a chance to look at the Barron's magazine, I read it cover to cover when they do their round table, and that's twice a year. And so for 20 years, Felix has been one of the members on that round table, along with Abby Joseph Cohen, from
Mark
Goldman
Faber.
Sachs, Mark Faber, yeah. Fred Hickey until recently. We will miss his contribution, but they have a variety of opinions. It's always interesting to me to see the difference between those with vast international exposure and experience, those who live elsewhere, and those who are in the U.S. And those who are in the U.S. usually speak with one voice. And I think Fred Hickey is sort of the standout who has a different opinion on many different things. But this Barron's roundtable discussion, the two voices that tend to stand out today are Felix Zuloff and Mark Faber. And I love reading their comments. Their analysis usually runs against the grain, not for the sake of being contrarian, but because they're thoughtfully engaged on a regular and routine basis. And I appreciate the honesty and the integrity that they bring to the process, constantly reappraising their assumptions and the world that we live in.
One of the things I appreciate is they don't seem to be struggling for position in that roundtable. They're very humble. I think about Felix. Felix doesn't make any bones about the fact that he's not trying to predict the future. In fact, he says, I really can't.
Felix Zuloff, a number of our listeners directly contacted us to request you as a guest once again for the commentary. William White was the last voice we heard from Switzerland. And now your perspective is a little different. You are a veteran and trader, an investor for more than 40 years. And twice annually, of course, you can be found in the Barron's magazine, their roundtable discussion with other investment luminaries. And that's where our listeners could find you as well. It's good to have you back on the program again, although it's been many years since you've been on the program. Now, one of the advantages of four decades experience in the field of economics and finance is that you've seen cycles come and go. You've seen fads come and go. You've seen ideas gain prominence and then be proven either correct or discredited. Let's start, if you will, with an overview of the current ideas and trends which are commonly believed, but which may lack credibility to a man of your experience.
Oh, that's a big question that covers virtually the whole spectrum. You know, the interesting thing is that when you live with markets for such a long time, that you go through different phases and different periods where different things really counted in the markets. And there were periods when you could use certain formulas that worked, and all of a sudden you enter a new era where the old formulas don't work anymore. For instance, in the 1970s, we had the inflation problem, and we had the breakdown of Bretton Woods, and that distorted what used to be a stable environment in the 50s and the 60s. And in the 80s and part of the 90s, authorities used primarily fiscal stimulation to get the economy going, and you had the buildup of debt. And actually with Greenspan came a new era that was monetary stimulation. And monetary policy most of the time was always too easy for too long. And that gave debt another kick. And we seem to have run out of certain stimulation for the world economy because all of a sudden all these things do not work anymore. In the last few years, we have gone through the biggest stimulation efforts in history in terms of monetary policy and at the beginning in terms of fiscal policy. And what you see today is a really lackluster global economy that is growing at very low rates, probably the lowest outside of a recession, certainly in nominal terms. And despite all the monetary stimulation and money printing, you have inflation rates heading south. And we have gone through inflation cycles now, actually since the 1970s, where you have always lower highs and lower lows in the cycle. And we used to call it disinflation. And now we have many economies seeing inflation rates in negative territory. And as monetary policy doesn't work the way the authorities expect it to, they have obviously gone to the next stage. And the next stage, what they are using today, is currency devaluation. The U.S. always used it as a weapon to help her economy. And then the Japanese came on in fall of 2012. Now, the Europeans are on it, and the other Asians are beginning to devalue their currency. Not aggressively yet, and probably it will all end once the Chinese kick in. That may be down the road another year or so. So we are trying that road, and that road won't work either, because it will work in the very short term for those who devalue decisively, but it's not going to work for the world in total, because the more aggressively one trading bloc devalues, the more deflationary pressure he introduces into the global pricing system. And that's the problem we have today. In U.S. dollar terms, we have globally priced manufactured goods down 10% year over year. That is something you only see in major economic crises, actually. Maybe the number is a little bit distorted because the high-flying dollar up to recently, but still, it shows you that there is more deflationary pressure and the process at work than anything else. And one has to wonder what comes after currency devaluation when the world ends up in a crisis or in a recession, and what will authorities use next? And I do not know the answer, but I doubt that all the big players are going to accept over the long term that others are going to aggressively devalue their currencies and let them walk away with that, you know. And therefore, I think you will have a situation globally where the geopolitical process is going to deteriorate. I think we see signs of that already. I think the trading blocs are rather, politically speaking, moving apart from each other and not closer together. So I think it's deglobalization to some degree that we are seeing, and we do not know where that leads to. And that brings on all these questions: what works in the markets and what doesn't, and what will the authorities do next? Because in today's world, it seems that, like in the 1970s, when on Thursday afternoons, everybody was running to the ticker tape to see what the newest M1 and M2 and M3 numbers were at that time. And they took a clue from there for the markets for the next few days. And today it's all monetary policy again, but it's a completely different dimension than it was at that time. So I do not have an answer. I just think we are going through cycles. But the eras that we have lived through in the last 40 years have been changing. And I think markets' personality has also been changing. And I have been a deflationist since the early 80s, and I discussed that with Alan Greenspan at that time, before he was Fed chairman, on a regular basis. And at that time, that was a very unpopular topic because the world was fascinated and focused on inflation problems. And now we are here after more than 30 years of declining inflation rates and declining interest rates. And I would never have believed that I would ever see negative nominal bond yields for government paper of longer duration. And here we are. We have in the euro area, we have virtually 2 trillion euros of government debt that offer a negative yield. And 10-year governments in Switzerland are in negative territory. And I expect German bund yields to also fall into a slightly negative territory over coming months. So it's a completely new setup. And when you have virtually zero yields or negative yields, you are pricing all sorts of assets off those yields and interest rates. And that is obviously distorting. And you know the effect when you go from 1% to 0.5%, that virtually doubles your PE ratio, so to speak, in a way. And the whole question then is, how long can this go on? And I do not have a firm answer on that. I think we are now 6 years in this bull market. If I'm not mistaken, the U.S. has never seen a bull market longer than 6 years. So maybe we are going to set records. But the risk is that sometimes later this year, we will have a bigger shakeout than most expect, at least in the U.S. market, brought on by the currency changes of late and what it all means for corporate profits. Because as long as you have an economy that struggles along in positive territory in growth rates, and as long as you have earnings not falling apart, you can inflate equity prices to unbelievably high levels. The problem probably arrives once the market realizes that maybe the fundamentals are not the like as expected. And then the problem may start. I'm not sure we are there yet at the end of a big bull market in equities. I doubt that. But I think we could have a big shakeout in the U.S., probably less so in Europe, because the Europe is now in a similar situation to Japan in 2013 when they started the aggressive QE, and the money that is printed cannot be taken up by the real economy for structural reasons, and therefore it stays within the financial economy. And as it stays in the financial economy, it inflates asset prices, and it continues to inflate asset prices until something gives. And that something could very well be corporate earnings. So I think in the U.S. we have the problem of multinational corporations headquartered in the U.S. and reporting in U.S. dollars, that all of a sudden the overseas earnings are worth less. And we could end up with negative or declining earnings for this year as a whole for the S&P 500. And that could shake the market somewhat. In Europe, it's just the other way around. I think there the earnings are going to surprise on the upside. And you have to keep in mind that usually multinationals operating worldwide, they do have a foreign exchange hedging program, but they usually hedge only part of what is out there. And usually they are on a 12-month hedging schedule. And we have now had a little bit over 9 months of strong dollar move. So I think we are coming to the point where it begins to bite in the earnings of the corporate sector. And therefore, the surprises in the U.S. will be on the negative side, the surprises in Europe are on the positive side. And you see that also in Japan, where the surprises recently have, and they have been leading, have been on the positive side. So it's an interesting world.
It's an incredibly interesting world. Niels Bohr, one of the great physicists of our day, commented that prediction is very difficult, especially if it's about the future. And that's where we find ourselves, looking to the future and saying, well, we have new monetary policies that are being pursued. And we have this sort of economic forecasting and portfolio construction, which assume a certain degree of freeness in the marketplace. I wonder, to what extent have the central banks of our day, led by Draghi, Bernanke, and now Yellen, Kuroda, Carney, and others, to what degree have they suspended cause and effect via monetary policy and limited that freeness element in the free market, leading us to something more of a command and control environment?
Well, I think that is a good point that you are raising. And monetary policy has been a contributor to our whole system moving more and more away from free market system. But it's not the only cause. There are political developments. When you have gone through a period of long prosperity, the political process likes to distribute that prosperity in a different way, and we go to more government intervention and more redistribution. And then we had the belief that we wanted to smooth the business cycle because the down part of the business cycle is very unpleasant, et cetera, et cetera. And the interventionism has grown bigger and bigger and bigger, and it is putting the free market society out of order. It cannot function anymore because it is not allowed to function. Had we allowed free markets to function, we would have had our serious recessions on the way, but structurally, the world would be in much better shape. We would not have the high debt burdens. We would not have the deflationary problems, et cetera, et cetera. We would not have inflated asset prices that make the upper class richer and richer and the lower class relatively poorer and poorer, et cetera, et cetera. So I think this whole belief in interventionism has really created a much worse world for the vast majority of people. And that's the bad thing. Free market and free spirit ideas unfortunately lost their power and lost their attraction by politicians. And that's the sad part. I don't want to elaborate more on that because that's a pretty sad story, because that's not very bright future for the longer term. I think we are moving more and more into a command-style economy with the free market part shrinking and the government share and the controlled part rising. And that, by definition, will lead to a situation for the mass of people that means less prosperity, harder work, less good life, more control, less freedom, etc., etc. And maybe it's because I'm getting older that I see these things that way. Maybe it's not. I don't know. But I'm not very fond of these trends. I don't like them. I think it's the completely wrong mindset that our politicians are applying to the system. And I would have loved to see them to apply more free spirit, more free market thinking and less interventionism. It's very clear what they had to do to get out of this mess. You know, nobody talks about it. Not even the investment community talks about it. And not even economists talk about it. All they had to do is they had to reduce the red tape in our system dramatically on a step-by-step basis. And they had to reduce the role of government dramatically on a step-by-step basis. And this would, of course, be in the short term negative for the economy. But that could be counterbalanced by infrastructure investments that our economies need. Over there in Europe and over here in the US and also in Japan, etc. And all you need is really the right mindset, a program, and the will to execute. And unfortunately, our political process is so short-sighted that we don't do what is necessary, and therefore we cannot exit that messy situation. Because a lot of people, particularly in the upper class, benefit from what's going on, at least in the short term, not in the long term. But, you know, when you do well, who complains? That's human nature.
We talked about smoothing the business cycle earlier through monetary policy. And over time, it seems that leverage also is a part of what has kept growth on track. But we also believe, as leverage has grown, that total systemic risk is reduced or offset by hedging, reinsurance programs, spreading the risk around via derivatives. What are we failing to imagine, which might in fact be the greatest issue or cause of instability over the next several years?
An individual corporation, even an individual country, perhaps, could hedge some risk. But the risk of the system as a whole cannot be hedged. You have to be aware of that. And of course, it is human nature that once risks being hedged, because nobody wants to live with high risks. But the more we hedge risks and the more we believe that there are no risks, and that means the bigger the systemic risk will eventually become. An example is all that managing of the business cycle. You know, we really succeeded in flattening and smoothing the business cycle. In the last 30 years, it has been smoother than any time before. However, we did so at the cost of building up huge systemic risks and imbalances. We have never had a debt situation like the current. When you look at global debt, how it has jumped over the last 15 years, it has more than doubled. Global debt outstanding, it's unbelievable, you know. And I have nothing against credit, but you have to differentiate between productive credit and unproductive credit. Productive credit is when you make an investment and that investment pays a return. And out of that return, you can amortize your debt and you can pay and service your debt, they pay the interest. And at the end, you still make a return on that investment. That's productive credit. Unproductive credit is you just spend it and you consume it, be it for consumption, a car or a vacation or heating or whatever. You just consume it and the debt stays there. And that's the problem we are in. Most of the government debt today is unproductive debt. Most of the corporate debt is productive debt, but not all, because corporations do make wrong investments and then they have to write it off. Most of the private household debt is unproductive debt. So the degree of unproductive debt and the size of unproductive debt in today's economy is just mind-boggling. And it's a restraining force. Even at these low interest rate levels, people always say, when interest rates are so low, you can afford more debt. Well, mathematically, that is true. But you have to understand that every individual has a capacity limit of debt. And I think more and more individuals and economic subjects in the world are hitting that capacity limit and cannot go beyond. And once you hit that point, it slows down economic growth. When you combine it with the aging in the demographic statistics, then you are destined to grow at lower and lower rates in the future. And that's where the world economy is, in my view. It's also important to understand that it's not just Europe and Japan that have bad demographics. The U.S. has much better demographics. But the emerging economies, the emerging markets, they have very bad and deteriorating demographics too, except for the Muslim states. But Korea, Taiwan, China, they have very bad demographics. So if you combine debt with demographics, you have very slow growth. And what our policymakers want is they want to go back and bring our economies back to growth rates that prevailed in the 1980s and 90s, where the world was able to assume more and more debt and therefore exaggerated final demand. And if you try to do that, it is a useless undertaking because you rather distort the whole economic system than you really help them.
You know, we have the transmission mechanism. If you consider the monetary policy that's in play today, you mentioned this earlier with Europe, where money is staying in the financial economy and it's not going into the real economy. We've seen the same thing in the U.S., and it appears that the transmission mechanism for monetary policy is broken. Perhaps this is a combination of reaching capacity limits for debt and demographics combined, yet the government continues to assume that more debt is just fine. In spite of not having exponential growth in the economy, we are continuing to see an exponential growth in liabilities. And the question of timing, how long can that continue? Is this something that continues on for decades? Is this something that continues on for years, months? What are the natural limits, particularly when you have a printing press? We know what the natural limits are for an individual or a corporation. You'll find that priced into the marketplace very quickly. But if you own a printing press, how long can you forestall those limits?
Well, that's a good question, but I doubt I have a good answer to it. You know, we always worry, and personally, I'm a worrier because I bought my first shares in 1968. That was just about near the peak of the secular bull market. And I learned my lessons. And then from 68 to 82, which was a long stretch, and in a professional formation of an individual like mine, that was a dominating part, and it was and markets were going up and down and up and down without any progress. But the progress was in the real economy. It seems today it's just the opposite. The progress is not in the real economy, it's rather more in the financial economy. So we always worried, and I always worried, how long is this going to continue? And it seems that there is always another rabbit they can pull out of the hat. I do not know. What I do know is that we could enter a new era. As I explained at the very beginning, I think the next era could very well be an era where the controls increase substantially. And that could include capital controls and things like that, where we are moving more and more away from what a free economic system used to be the case. It doesn't mean that markets have to be bad. Look, in recent years, in the last 10 years or so, the best stock market in the world was Venezuela. And even in dollar terms, it was the best stock market in the world. But would you really have liked to invest in Venezuela 10 years ago in the real economy? The real economy is a mess. It's a dramatic mess. And it's a controlled situation. The people cannot take the money out of the country, et cetera, et cetera. So it creates the imagination that everything is fine because the stock prices go up. That's wrong. I think looking at stock prices and taking that as a guide in which direction future prosperity goes is the wrong way of looking at it. Venezuela obviously has high inflation, but even adjusted for inflation, it's been a pretty good performance. Why? Because the money cannot go outside of the country, and they print money, and therefore the money has to go somewhere, and it inflates stock prices. Now, this continues until it doesn't anymore. And then you have a currency reform, and then you can start anew. Will that really make you rich and wealthy and prosperous? I doubt. And my fear is that some of the industrialized countries could, over the next 20, 30 years, move into such a situation. That's my biggest fear, because it would be terrible, particularly for our children. I could live with that, but I think for our children, for the generation of our children, it would be horrible. And that's why I'm criticizing wherever I can what policymakers are doing when I think it's wrong.
You know, when you say that it's not the real economies that are driving prices, it seems that to some degree, if you have two nickels to your name, you're being forced to become a speculator. We turn to currencies really quickly, and one of the assets which are the charge of central bankers are currencies. We're seeing massive currency volatility over the last 6 to 12 months. What, in your opinion, are driving the dynamics within the currency markets and the current volatility that we're seeing?
Well, obviously, it's the difference in the structural and cyclical setup of different economies and the application of different policies in those economies that drives the value of exchange rates. And we have seen the U.S. in a terminal stage of QE and a perceived terminal stage of low interest rate policy, and approaching the point of normalization, as they call it. And we see at the same time that the Europeans go one step further and enter a more aggressive period of monetary policy easing and quantitative easing and creating new money and buying bonds at unbelievable quantities. So this difference, obviously, is an important factor in driving currency values. And then it really depends on what the setup is, how market participants are positioned before you go into such a situation where major changes make exchange rates move. And the setup here, and you have to go back a little over the last 10 years or so, we have come out of a period where the U.S. Central Bank was the most aggressive in monetary easing and money printing, and they made the U.S. dollar very cheap and therefore created a situation where the U.S. dollar was used as a funding currency worldwide outside of the U.S. And when you look at the quantities of debt created, denominated in U.S. dollars outside of the U.S., it's pretty mind-boggling. The emerging markets alone, according to the BIS statistics, did it on a basis of about $6 to $7 trillion U.S. dollars. And the total, according to BIS, or the latest number I have in mind, is about $9 trillion. So I would assume that is at least $10 trillion, if not more, U.S. dollar denominated debt outside the U.S. And as long as the dollar is stable or weak, that's fine. The problem arrives when all of a sudden the dollar begins to rise, as it has done since the middle of last year, and rises dramatically due to the cyclical shift in policies among two major blocks. And then, obviously, for those indebted in U.S. dollars, it means that your debt on your balance sheet is growing every day. And that's an unbearable situation, and it resembles the position of a short position. And therefore, those have to do something about it, and they have to cut losses short by hedging, by closing positions. And I think part of the outstanding $10 trillion has been done, but that's probably a very small part. And I think a bigger part is still ahead. So I doubt that the recent dollar run is all there was. I think we are now going through a correction, and that correction could last several months, and it will be justified by softer U.S. economic numbers that will come along, and that is going to be justified. And the correction is all about repositioning by the speculators. I think you will see that the real dollar debtors out there, those who are short the dollar, they will use this correction to reduce their position, and that will support the U.S. dollar. And that's why I think the correction of the U.S. dollar will not be very deep. It could be lengthy, several months, but it won't be very deep. I figured it could be, if I had to guess, I would say about 7% from top to low, but several months in duration. And after that, I think these structural forces of that dollar-denominated debt out there will continue to push the U.S. dollar higher. Because when you look around in the world, what currency would you really like to have your capital, your own wealth, denominated in? You know, would you like to have euro? Can you really trust that currency, which is artificial and tries to combine 19 structurally different economies with one set of monetary interest rate and foreign exchange policy? That doesn't make any sense. And the history of monetary unions is not a good one. They virtually always break apart.
So you see a competition for safe havens of sort between the Danish, Swedish, Swiss, U.S. currencies?
Well, you know, the Danish krona is linked to the euro. It's not an official peg, but it is pegged to the euro, and they will try to keep it that way. The Swiss franc is a special situation. We tried to cap the strengthening of the Swiss franc with that cap at 120, euro Swiss franc at 120. And once the ECB decided to go on this QE program, the Swiss National Bank had to remove that cap, because you cannot have an economy that is doing relatively well, Switzerland, have the same aggressively expansive monetary policy as the ECB. And therefore, the decision was right. I would have done it a little bit sooner than that. I would have done it a year ago or so. So the Swiss franc will remain a strong currency, but we can only accept a certain overvaluation. When the overvaluation goes beyond a certain limit, we cannot live with it. We can always live with an overvaluation of, let's say, 15 to 20%. And against the currencies of our major trading partners. And the Eurozone is our major trading partner. And Switzerland's export industry, which is virtually half of the GDP, really depends largely to that. So we can live with a 15-20% overvaluation because it forces us to keep becoming more and more efficient, more and more productive, to constantly move up the value chain and move to more value-added industries and services and products. And that is very good for the prosperity of the vast majority of the people. But if you have a shock by increasing the value of your currency by 30 or 40% in a short period of time, then you have a serious recession and you could even destroy economic structures. And that's what we cannot tolerate. And therefore, I said a few years ago when we had the problem with the Swiss franc strengthening, I said, there is no way for Switzerland they can escape currency controls. Eventually, they have to introduce currency controls. It's such a small currency market. It's such a tiny country. And if the world all of a sudden decides we want to own Swiss francs, it destroys our economy. And therefore, we can only live, I think, in today's world where things are so out of balance everywhere, we will eventually need currency controls. The Swiss National Bank has not done it yet because they don't want to go into a currency control situation. But I think there is no escape in the medium term. They have to introduce it. And that is another important point brought up. If we enter an era in coming years of more and more currency controls, you have to decide very early where you want to be with your capital. Because all of a sudden, it could mean that when currency controls are applied, you are either locked in or locked out of positions you want or you don't want to be. So you have to make your decision very early and think about it, where you really want to be with your capital.
Now, a question, I mean, because obviously last year gold performed well as a currency, and that's the elephant in the room. Where do you want to be with your capital? Gold is something of a transnational currency, or do you think that that would fall under the sort of controlled elements that we've described in the context of deglobalization and politicians trying to control more and more capital controls, sort of a return to what we had in the 80s and 90s being something that we will see in the future? Do they begin to control the flows and pricing of gold as well as a means of making sure that you don't have capital mobility?
In an idealized free world, gold would be an ideal currency because it has no debt, it is not mismanaged, etc., etc. And it is available at relatively limited quantities and you cannot create them overnight out of thin air. So it would be an ideal currency in terms of storing your wealth. But we don't live in a free and idealized free world. And I think eventually gold will fulfill its function that it lends you protection against mismanagement by politics and policymakers, etc. But, you know, the question is then, if it does give you the protection by, let's say, rising dramatically in price or so, does one really believe that you can walk away untaxed from such gains that are your hedges against bad policies? And there I have my doubts and reservations.
We've talked a lot about the liquidity in the emerging markets and the debt that has been developed there, $6 to $7 trillion just in the last decade or so. It brings to mind the crises of the last several decades, Mexico in 94, Asia in 97, Russia in 98, Argentina in 2001, and then again more recently. What does the world look like with the U.S. running a smaller trade deficit and emerging markets no longer accumulating surplus dollars at the rate we've witnessed in the recent past?
Well, actually, the trade deficit is part of the current account deficit, and you have to look at the current account deficit because that is the channel through which the U.S. supplies dollars to the rest of the world, and through trade and services, et cetera, et cetera. And that current account deficit has been shrinking over the last, 5 years or 6 years or so. That means the U.S. has supplied less and less dollars through this channel to the rest of the world, and therefore there is probably some sort of temporary shortage, so to speak, because, as I explained before, the world has brought itself into a very large short position of US dollars. And when you then tighten or restrict, so to speak, the supply of US dollars, as has been happening in recent years, you all of a sudden bring the dollar to an eruption. And that has happened over the last 9 months or so. I saw that very early. I pounded the table in early 2014, and I said it again in mid-year 14 and again in January of this year. So I think this is a cyclical bull run of the US dollar. Whether it is the beginning of a structural, a relative increase in value versus other currencies over the longer term, I do not know. It's too early to tell. I just want to get the cycle right, and then we have another look when I think the cycle is over. It's not over yet. It's just a pause, and it could be a lengthy and choppy pause, but it should continue thereafter.
It seems like the cyclical bull run on the dollar is something that not only shrinks global liquidity, but does reinforce a deflationary trend globally. Does that cause our trade partners to look very differently at the dollar system, the dollarized world that we live in?
I think they do not have the time to have a closer look at those issues. They are so messed up in their own local and regional and national situations that they do not have time to really think deeply about the structural issues and the longer term. The only ones who do that, I would say, are the Chinese, but they are also in a delicate situation as their economy is slowing down and will probably slow down for several years to come.
You know, the Eurozone is something that you live with, living most of your time on the continent and near to it. I wonder, what does the Eurozone look like in 5 years' time? Does the EMU even exist in, say, 10 years? And who's likely to move back to an independent currency? Greece, Spain, Italy, Portugal, France, Germany? Could we go back to the old Deutschmark, or is that really what the euro has become, is a proxy for German credit?
The setup of the euro requires higher growth for even the weakest members, because if you do not get higher growth to improve the economic situation of the people, and you don't give them jobs, and you don't give them income that make their living more bearable and better, then you run into a political problem. Interestingly, the more a trading bloc, like the Europeans, go for currency devaluation, most people don't understand that. The more they do so, the more they create more pressure in the intensification of the deflationary process of the global economy. And that means, paradoxically, the more they inflate, the more deflation the world economy will eventually suffer. And the more intense deflationary process we have, the higher the risk is that the weaker members of the Eurozone cannot cope with the economic framework they are in. And therefore, strangely enough, what Draghi does, and he doesn't know it because nobody explained it to him, the more he does what he's doing, the higher the risk that the euro will break, because the weakest members will not be able to bear it and to live with it. And therefore, I would say that I have always said within the next 5 to 7 years, I expect major changes in the euro. I do not believe that it will break apart just in one day and then it's gone. I think it will be a process, and it will be a chaotic process, because the best thing would be to have a plan and then you can control the process. If you have no plan, and even worse, if you are completely against it and you fight it and it's a taboo, the more disorderly and the more chaotic the process will be. And I think Greece will eventually default, maybe not this time, maybe they can walk away again, maybe they get the money from the Germans with which they can pay back the Germans, etc., etc. But eventually Greece will default. When they default, they have to reform and restructure. When they restructure, they need to be competitive, and to make it work, they need a cheaper currency. they need a central bank to finance a new start. And the ECB will hardly be the financier for that. And therefore, I think once Greece defaults in coming years, at that time, Greece will not be able to stay in the euro. And they will exit. And that will create a prejudice for others. And others that are at risk, of course, are the obvious candidates, Portugal, Spain, Italy, and then the big question mark is France, because France cannot live inside the eurozone for long in the current setup. And then all bets are off. You know, it will be chaos. Probably they will try to save it in a smaller version. You have a few exits and things like that. But that will not be very pleasant. And it will be the result of a bad idea, badly introduced and badly run and badly managed. And that's the price you have to pay for that.
The majority of our conversation today, Felix, has been about economics and finance, and we've ventured into a little bit of the social and political consequences. As we wrap up, I want to see if you would look at the war cycle. Is there an overlay with the war cycle for the current economic and financial picture we've just described?
Well, I'm not an expert on that, but when I look at the longer-term cycles, every second decade of the last 800 years, there has been a major war, and you have shorter cycles of war activity, and all of those are pointing upwards, and we have seen more conflict erupting recently, even in Eastern Europe, and I doubt that is over. Putin wants to rebuild part of the Soviet Empire, which I understand from a national point of view of the Russians. The Western Europeans have expanded their territory. The NATO bloc and EU bloc has expanded eastwards. That creates conflicts, of course. We have China rising economically and also militarily. I see that in the defense industry, the Asians are the ones that are rebuilding their defense, their strategic defenses. They are spending more and more money on it. They are very concerned about it. So whenever you have a situation where you have slowing growth for structural reasons, where you have declining prosperity for an increasing part of the population, you run into the risks of conflicts because the people are dissatisfied and they request changes. And some dumb politicians could use others as scapegoats for their own mistakes, and then you have a problem. So there could be more conflicts ahead, but I'm not expert enough to forecast them, really. I just think that the world, we are entering a new era, and the world will not be as it used to be in the last 20 or 40 years. It will be different, and I'm not sure it will be more pleasant.
Now, just as I know we concluded with that thought on the war cycle, but an abbreviated version of what you've done with Barron's Roundtable, not in terms of specific calls, but sort of general asset classes. If we're moving into a new era and the last 20 to 40 years cannot be presumed to be the context we're in today, where would you want to invest, say, with a 12-month time frame, or even shift gears completely to, say, a 48 to 60-month time frame, a 4 to 5-year time frame? Too much may change beyond that kind of a scope, but would you give advice to your children or grandchildren to say, yes, be cautious, but here's how I would be positioned in the short run, intermediate run, or long run?
Well, I do have certain long-term visions, whether they are right or wrong, but I grew up as a trader and I still trade. And I think what is most important in this environment is not to lose sight of managing your risks. Last time markets turned down in 07, 08, you know, if you didn't do your risk management properly, you suffered serious losses. And nobody can forecast the future accurately, consistently. That does not exist. Nobody can. And I'm one of those nobodies who cannot forecast the future. So the best thing to have, I think, is a business with a product that is in high demand as a daily necessity for people. That's the ultimate investment. That's the best investment you can have. And you have your own company and your own business. That's the best. Obviously, then you want to have some real estate. So you diversify. You want to have some real estate. And you want to have it primarily in a region where there is a good legal system in place, where there is a good government in place, where you have good demographic situation, where you have rising prosperity. Then you buy real estate in those areas. Or if you can pick up bargains in a crisis, that's always good. You know, you wait until a crisis is there and then you pick up bargains in a crisis. I picked up bargains in the last serious real estate crisis we had in Switzerland, which was in the second half of the 90s. So you could buy commercial real estate a few years old at 40% of their costs and things like that. That's what good value and good investments are. In terms of bonds, you know, at the present time where we are, you can only be a trader. You cannot be an investor in bonds anymore because these low yield levels could last maybe longer than many perceive, but they are not sustainable. At some point, there will be a normalization, maybe not the way the world thinks, maybe not through a normalization of the economy, maybe through a crisis. But if a cycle of defaults begins, you know, interest rates go up. So you cannot invest in bonds long term, but you can trade them. And I'm still long U.S. Treasuries. That's my biggest fixed income holding. In equities, I think you want to be, again, in a system that has a good legal system where you have the entrepreneurship that is good, and you try to find companies that produce services and products that are in demand, where consumers, for their daily necessities, cannot go around it. I would not go into deep cyclicals because you need timing capabilities to do that. I would rather go with solid blue chip type of companies. If this cycle runs longer than most think, then I think you will see most likely a new Nifty 50 developing. That's where all the money is going and concentrating in companies where they feel safe. And, you know, it's the Disney's of this world. It's the Nestle's and Novartis of this world. It's the Henkel of this world. Those are just a few names. So you could see outrageous valuations when these stocks top, but there will be a down cycle and the next down cycle could be ugly. I do not know when it begins. My hunch is that it could start sometimes in 16. And then we'll see. So it's very difficult to make at this level of valuations and after 6 years into a bull market to make long-term recommendations in equities, although equities, very long-term, are the preferred asset class.
We always enjoy your comments via Barron's or here on the program and appreciate you joining us from the East Coast. Perhaps we will gather and share a meal and share conversation sometime in Zurich or Geneva next time we're in Switzerland.
Oh, please do so. And thank you very much for having me, David.
Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Felix Zuloff. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.